It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Instagram is marketed as a place for positivity filled with pretty photos, cute dogs, and inspirational quotes. But our guest says all this positivity might actually be making users unhappy. First, the midterm elections are just 3 weeks from today. Governor Walker and his Democratic opponent, State Superintendent Tony Evers, are unveiling some policy promises in the run-up to Election Day. They center on school funding levels and income tax relief. Walker and Evers are in a statistical tie, according to the latest Marquette University Law School poll, as they head into their first debate this Friday in Madison. Another poll has Evers with the lead. So how much of an effect will these proposals have on voters? Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Democracy Lab. Amber, welcome to Central Time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dig into the policy proposals from Governor Walker and Superintendent Evers, with the Democrat talking about wanting to do tax cuts, with the governor, the Republican, wanting to restore some education funding, are these candidates trying to reach over and get some independence here as opposed to messages directed at their own bases?
I think that's right. I think if you look at recent polling data, and this isn't new, this is a longstanding trend, Republican candidates do well amongst Republican voters. Democratic candidates do well amongst Democratic voters. And so although I would say that this election is very much going to be a turnout election, so Republicans and Democrats are going to do everything that they can to get their supporters out, at the margins, reaching out and being able to persuade some independent voters, it could be the key in this election.
All right, that's the politics a little bit. Let's look at some of the policies they're talking about now. Governor Walker said yesterday, if he's reelected, he'll restore this state commitment to funding schools to 2/3 of their total costs. Superintendent Evers had proposed the same thing back in the summer. There's a long-running, kind of complicated policy issue in the state. Can you talk about the importance of it?
Sure. Well, when we look at the last, you know, the first two terms of Walker, and of course Walker also faced the recall election, he ran in a different climate. If you look back at polling, you know, several years ago, the climate in the state was, you know, Wisconsinites were not so concerned about the spending side. They were interested in the tax cut side. Fast forward a few years, and over the last year of polling here in the state, what we're seeing is that Wisconsinites are concerned about kind of these basic services and whether or not the funding is there to support schools, to provide infrastructure improvements, and the like. And so I think what we are seeing from Governor Walker in particular is this recognition that this is a slightly different political climate that he's looking at in this re-election fight. Of course, if you also look back in the previous elections, he ran in years that were pretty good for Republican candidates nationwide. What we're seeing this year, if you look at the special elections and so on, that this could be shaping up to be a good year for Democrats nationwide, but also in Wisconsin. So I think what you're seeing from Governor Walker is some calculation about what are the messages that are going to resonate with enough voters to carry him through on Election Day.
Right. In surveys from your Marquette University colleagues over at the law school, the Marquette Law School poll, some of their questions have asked about, do you prioritize tax cuts or spending on things like education? And it does seem like there's been a shift there, exactly what you were saying, toward less people wanting the tax cuts, more people wanting that investment.
That's exactly right. And so I think what you're seeing from both candidates is a responsiveness to that shift in public sentiment.
So we're seeing both candidates say, okay, 2/3 funding. That would cost money, though, to do that. Are they talking about where Walker or Evers talking about exactly where the money comes from to bring the state back up to that 2/3 commitment, the state paying for 2/3 of school costs?
That's right. I think if you look at Walker's proposal, we're not seeing many details at this particular point about where the funding is going to come from. So this is a big question kind of as he goes forward on the campaign trail. I'm sure he's going to face lots of those sorts of questions. For Tony Evers, you know, for his kind of proposals, everything from education and infrastructure, healthcare, and so on, you have seen some details there looking at kind of a balancing of tax policy in order to increase spending in certain areas. So he's talked about raising taxes, or removing, I guess, kind of tax breaks for manufacturers and agriculture tax credit in the state, looking at perhaps increasing taxes on high-end earners, high-income earners. There's been some discussion about, is the gas tax in the mix or not? We've seen it a bit more on the where might revenue come from for the proposals on Evers' side, less so on Walker's side, though I anticipate that these are the sorts of questions that he'll be asked in the coming weeks.
Talking to Amber Wachowski from Marquette University, Associate Professor of Political Science there and Director of the Marquette Democracy Lab, looking at the latest messages from the big party candidates in the race for governor. Amber, staying with taxes, Governor Walker all along has been very much held the line in any kind of tax increase, especially leading up to his presidential campaign. Superintendent Evers, more of a mixed message, saying, as you were just outlining there, ending those tax breaks for higher end earners, that industrial and agriculture credit, but also saying he wants to cut income tax for middle income earners. How do you think that those two messages square with voters?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of tax message from Evers' side, much more kind of, you know, both Evers and Walker in their tax proposal are going to have redistributive effects, you know, where the bulk of the benefits go to up and down the income ladder. I think from Evers' perspective, that message of a middle-class tax cut, increasing taxes on top-end earners, though that tends to be a kind of a tax mix or policy that tends to draw pretty broad support from voters, both if you look at national polls as well as some polling kind of state by state. Now, whether or not that's going to be enough to, you know, convince independent voters against kind of Walker's campaign message, which is that things are going well, that the state economy is on the uptick, unemployment is down, wages are starting to come up. Those are going to be kind of the competing messages from Evers' side, you know, making the message that these years with Walker have not done enough, that the prosperity has not been broadly shared. And certainly from Walker's perspective, it's going to be, this is going back to, you know, the kind of tax and spend Democrats and an undoing of all the policies that are putting the state in a more competitive position. So those are the two competing messages coming out from both camps. Again, we're in a very polarized time where if you even just look at public opinion polling on views of the economy, it's remarkable. You almost saw this overnight shift where following Trump's election, where Republicans all of a sudden, you know, under Obama, were pretty sour on the economy, under Trump are saying the economy looks great. And it nearly overnight, same sort of shift with Democrats. So you've got some pretty dug-in partisans on both sides. And so trying to reach out to those independent voters is tricky. And it's also tricky in a midterm election year, where we would expect that kind of the diehard partisans, those who are very politically engaged, they're mobilized. They will turn out to vote in a few weeks. And so you've got both the trying to persuade independent voters who maybe haven't not made up their mind, not only on the vote choice, which candidate to support, but you're also trying to mobilize and get them to turn out to the polls on Election Day.
One thing that strikes me with this tone of partisanship in those Marquette Law School polls, we see a Democrat, Tammy Baldwin, having a substantial lead over Republican Leah Vukmir in the Senate polls, but neck and neck in the most recent one for Governor Walker and Superintendent Evers, which suggests, if I'm doing the math right, there's some people who are going to vote for a Democrat in one race and maybe for a Republican in another. Those people still exist, it sounds like?
They certainly do. They are a smaller slice of the Wisconsin electorate in terms of the split ticket voters, but they do exist. And I think what you see there is, you know, both Baldwin and Walker are the incumbents. And incumbents do tend to have a bit of an incumbency advantage, particularly if the economic kind of climate is right. We aren't, you know, the economy statewide on some metrics is looking stronger. And so that tends to be an environment where incumbents have a bit of an advantage. And so I think with the polling there, seeing both Tammy Baldwin up And in the latest poll, I think Walker was up maybe by a point, but really it's a statistical tie. It's a dead heat. You know, you might have both candidates benefiting a little bit from an incumbency advantage, and I would expect that you will have some crossover voters, some voters who are going to be, or I should say split-ticket voters, come Election Day.
As we wrap up, if I'm a candidate and I drop a message about tax cuts or school funding inside a month till Election Day, is that too late? Is there still time to move the needle?
You know, that's a great question. Well, I'll be able to say more about that after Election Day. You know, given what we'll see in terms of turnout, I think that the slice of the electorate to try to persuade to mobilize is smaller. But these elections can turn on the margins, right? It can be a very, very close race. And so these sorts of messages, we do know that less partisan voters are more likely to tune in later in the election cycle. And so kind of a month out from the election day is when many of these voters are kind of paying attention, picking up on some of the campaign messages. But the crucial point is, are they going to turn out and vote? And so you've got this kind of 1-2 punch, both persuading as well as mobilizing and getting them to the polls. It's easier on for Republicans to kind of mobilize their base. Republican voters tend to skew older, more less kind of residential instability. It tends to kind of promote higher rates of turnout in midterm election years. So sometimes Republican candidates can be benefited in midterm races, but this is also, as Walker had kind of pointed out earlier in the year, you know, we might be looking at a blue wave in Wisconsin, and there's a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic side. And so trying to expand and broaden the electorate, I think, is a real challenge. And I think it's going to be a particular challenge for Tony Evers. I think this is going to be, he's going to need turnout on his side.
Amber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks very much for having me.
Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Democracy Lab. We talked to her about the latest proposals for funding schools and cutting taxes in the race for governor. Right now, of all the social media options out there, Instagram has frequently been thought of as the friendly option, with many user feeds filled with pictures of pets, food, and travel destinations. But our next guest says that while Facebook might demonstrate that a lot of us are kind of boring, and Twitter reveals that a lot of us like to argue, Instagram seems to be the place where everyone seems to be living their perfect life, except maybe for you. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you use Instagram, what do you get out of the experience? Do you use it for inspiration or to see photos of friends and family's lives? Do you feel content with that experience, or do you come away feeling maybe a little jealous of all the cool stuff everybody else is doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alex Hearn is a technology reporter for The Guardian, joining us from the UK. He wrote the piece, Instagram is supposed to be friendly, so why is it making people so miserable? Alex, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, Alex, a lot of people are familiar with Facebook. Instagram, it's popular, but the user numbers are smaller. So give us a quick Instagram 101 for people who haven't been on the service.
It is, like you say, it's Facebook's second social network. It's owned by the same company. They acquired it 6 years ago. And it's an image and video sharing focused network. So people post pictures and video onto the site. It shows up in a scrollable newsfeed style list of posts, and you can add text comments underneath. It's sort of lightly based on Twitter, or at least what Twitter was 6 years ago. And then as a separate story, there is a new sort of second element to the site, which is called Instagram Stories, which is still, importantly for this narrative, very image and video led.
And Instagram, you write, really pitched itself and tried to cultivate the reputation that, hey, this is the friendly, happy social media place. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah. And I think some of that is true. You know, one of the big things about having a social network that's so based around visual communication is that a lot of the things that aggravate, let's say, people about Twitter and Facebook, its two main competitors, don't really exist in the same level. You know, crucially, there's not huge arguments about politics on Instagram. There's not that much awful world news. It tends to be images of, you know, things that look good, be that beautiful people, beautiful art, beautiful places, beautiful food. It is very much a place where successful Instagrammers tend to, and obviously there are always exceptions to something with north of 500 million users, but successful Instagram users tend to share pictures of things that you want to look at.
And that's where we start to run into trouble. What got you started on this path of Instagram maybe being too good, the images being too good and making us feel bad?
Well, so for me, it was kind of a personal thing. I realized about myself that I don't like myself when I'm on any social network, but normally it's about overuse. You know, I come out of a Twitter hole and I've spent an hour there and it's awful and I've done nothing, but it's mostly just, oh God, I could have done something better with that time. What I noticed about Instagram was that I would open it within 5 minutes. I would actively feel, you know, a bit crappy. I would be sad that I wasn't out with my friends who were at that cool bar, or I'd be sad that all of my cooking was really lame compared to my friend who's done an amazing pasta bake, or I'd be upset that I'm not going to the gym as much as my friend who's really gained some abs over the summer. You know, all of those little things would just combine to leave me feeling crappy.
And I've seen the case made on Facebook in some cases, but maybe this is more true on Instagram, that we're getting the carefully edited and curated best of somebody else's life and then comparing it to our own everyday life, all the stuff. Is that part of the problem?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's very easy to know that consciously, to sit there and go, well, no, you know, I'm sitting here on a Tuesday night looking at Instagram, but yeah. My friend posted one picture in the whole of the last week, and it was the highlight of their entire week, and I'm comparing that to me on a schlobby Tuesday. Like, obviously, yes, you're not going to come off well with that. But the problem is, it's not a conscious thing. You know, you can tell yourself this, but all the same, that doesn't help. You still have this fear of missing out. You have this feeling that you're inferior. You often have this feeling that, oh, well, you know, when I took my picture like that, which I posted to the site last week, I was faking it for the cameras. I was doing this artifice. But they look really happy. So, you know, they must be really feeling it.
And then it's going to be a spiral, right? If I'm in that zone, then on my next picture that I post, I'm going to really try to up the ante and make it even better picture. So it's and then I'll put that feeling on everybody else.
Exactly. So there you really do get, you get this sort of tacit competition, and you just get, well, you get the end result of Instagram, which is a social network where it documents perfection. And it documents perfection in a very relatable way. It makes, unlike perhaps, you know, traditional broadcast TV or glossy magazines, it is perfection of your friends. And if they're not your real friends in real life, they're often people who feel like they could be your friends. You know, they feel relatable. They feel like they are living a very similar life to you. All of which makes that comparison that people make all the harder to actually stand up to.
You feel this on Instagram. A lot of people feel this on Instagram. What do you think is the solution? Is there a better way to use this service, or is abstinence the best answer when it comes to the service?
Yeah, you know, I've not come up with an answer that I'm happy with. About half the people I spoke to who say that they love Instagram said that they found that the best thing to do was to focus on friends and family, to use it not as a way of looking at these perfect influencers with beautiful bodies and incredible lives, but just to keep up with the people they really care about. The other half said exactly the opposite. They said that the problem was that your friends and family sharing, you know, the lovely meals that they go on, that's what really gets you, because you know you could be doing that. You really know your friends and family. At least influencers, at least these perfect model celebrities, with them, you can know that you're not living their life. You can turn to them for inspiration, but you can distance yourself a bit. For me, certainly, I had a bit of introspection, and I found that it was the friends and family who were actually the ones who hurt me most, and it was very much a sort of fear of missing out thing. It was realizing that the thing that really cut to me was when I saw two of my friends together having fun, and always felt like, why didn't they invite me? Why wasn't I the third one? Probably because I said no. I'm quite a homebody. I like staying on the sofa.
So how have you cut yourself loose from Instagram? Do you email pictures to people if you have a picture you want to share? How do you manage this now?
I I do use Instagram a lot less than I used to after this. I have, partially because I can't quite bring myself to unfollow friends and family because, you know, I'm British. We're terribly polite, and that just feels rude to me. So rather than spark that confrontation, I've just stopped opening the app all that much. I use WhatsApp a lot. I quite like the direct communication of that. I feel like, you know, I send pictures to people who want to see pictures, but I try and sort of post things into the ether a bit less. I try and be a bit more direct and focused with my communication. And also, you know, I am actually just trying to spend less time on my phone and see the world. It's awfully banal, and it's the sort of thing which would sound terrible coming from an Instagram influencer, but it's kind of true.
Big picture, Alex, do you think we've just dived into all forms of social media a little too headlong, and maybe we need to do what you did in this piece, think and be intentional about how we use it?
Yeah, I really do. I think that the change in the world over the last decade has been huge, extremely quickly, and largely unintended even by the creators of these products, these services. I don't think we'll be using these tools the same way in a decade's time, and I don't think that will be because, you know, some other new hotness has replaced them. I think that we're going to get sort of societal mores will come in. It will be seen as just in the same way that it's seen as a bit odd if you don't leave your house for 2 weeks. It will start to be seen as just a bit odd if you're the sort of person who is on social media all this time, or the sort of person who's posting certain types of content, or the sort of person, you know, will just end up, I hope, if everything comes out well at the other side, we'll end up having these little societal understandings about what is and isn't a healthy way to use these products.
Alex, thanks for joining us, and we won't follow you on Instagram.
Thank you very much.
That's Alex Hearn, technology reporter for The Guardian. He joined us from the UK to talk about his piece, Instagram is supposed to be friendly, so why is it making people so miserable? First, there's a lot of frustration with our democracy today. Many people say they don't feel like their voice matters, that politicians don't have a reason to listen to their opinion. Others are simply sick and tired of angry partisanship of the past few election cycles. But our next guest has spent years working with an idea that could offer some relief, deliberative democracy. Put into practice all around the world, it brings people together to learn about and discuss political issues and then offer their opinions. James Fishkin is a professor of political science and communication at Stanford University. He directs the Center for Deliberative Democracy. He's the author of the new book, Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, spell out for us what we mean by deliberative democracy.
Well, the root idea of deliberation is weighing the competing arguments and reasons, particularly if you have good information about them. Most of the time, most people around the world in most countries are not focused on the complexities of policy issues. They are, to use the phrase of some social scientists, quote, rationally ignorant, unquote. That is, if I have a lot of, if I have only one vote in millions and only one voice in millions or hundreds of thousands, why should I spend a lot of time thinking about these complicated issues, particularly when people are trying to manipulate my opinion, misinform me, or just not interested in listening? And if I do talk about politics or policy, I may get into an argument that's unpleasant. So many people tune out or they don't invest much time in thinking about it. My colleagues in political science have generally come to the conclusion that that means the public is stupid. No, the public's not stupid. It's just they don't think they're not effectively motivated to really think through the issues. So my question is, what would the people think under conditions where they thought their voice mattered and where they could get good information and where they could be assured of a civil, mutually respectful conversation? So we have a method for realizing deliberative democracy in practice. I call it deliberative polling. We've done it 109 times in 28 countries, in many cases with consequential results that have affected policies and that have brought people from very different perspectives together. So it's a very simple idea, but it works. And it's worth trying in an age of great polarization, disaffection, And we're actually, democracy itself is in crisis because it's in disrepute in the sense that the approval ratings for politicians are in the same area as for, I don't want to insult undertakers and used car salesmen, but they're roughly in that area. And this is not just in the United States. It's all over the world. So I think we need to think about reform, not replacing, but we need to think about targeted reforms and entry points where it's practical and safe to bring the people's views to bear.
Let's talk about this method now that you've talked about in theory and you've used it in practice from California to Mongolia. What is deliberative polling?
It's very simple. An ordinary poll just offers the public's reflection of sound bites and headlines, because the public hasn't thought very much about the issues. The good thing about polling, when done well, is you get a good scientific sample, so you can represent the opinions, and that's different from self-selected mobilization, which is just going to get the people who feel really strongly. So we begin with good polling. Actually, we begin with preparations on an issue where we have an advisory group representing different points of view, and we prepare materials that have arguments for and against different policy options that are going to be the subject of the poll. We vet those so that they're lucid, readable, and accurate. Sometimes we also have a video version in case some people are not so literate to make the same information accessible. Then what we do is we take a good survey about those policy options and the reasons why people might support or oppose an option. Then what we do, so that's ordinary polling, but then we build on top of that. We actually recruit the people to come to a single place, well, either face-to-face or sometimes it's online with video small group discussions like Google Hangouts or other software, but usually face-to-face, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700 people, a good sample of the population, divided into small groups, randomly divided so they're diverse, with trained moderators who don't offer any opinion but just facilitate a mutually respectful discussion. And the discussion is of the policy options, the pros and cons, and then they come up with questions that they direct to panels of competing experts and politicians who offer competing answers to the questions, only to the questions of the people. And then we alternate. Let's say it's a whole weekend, and we alternate an hour and a half small group, an hour and a half plenary, another hour and a half small group, another hour and a half plenary, until we work through the whole agenda and the people have really not only had a dialogue with the experts and politicians, but with each other. And they've learned to listen to each other, even though people from different points of view normally now in this polarized world don't talk to each other at all, and they don't consult websites that will give them the other point of view. Well, here they actually listen and talk, and then they take the same at the end of the weekend. I'm saying it's a weekend for because that's the usual format. At the end of the weekend, they take the same survey that they did on first contact, and we see the changes of opinion. And maybe two-thirds of the time, the opinions change significantly, sometimes very dramatically. Those final opinions are the considered judgments of the people of a representative and informed sample. So we put all of America or all of California or, as you mentioned, Mongolia. I'm just back from Mongolia, all of Mongolia in one room, or even all of the European Union, 27 countries at the time, now 28, maybe going back to 27, but the whole population in one room where it can think together, reason together, and listen to each other, and then decide what they really think in individual confidential questionnaires like secret ballots. So, that, in other words, that's what the people would think if they were thinking. And it's usually pretty smart. It may not be what I think or what any individual thinks, but they usually have good reasons for the conclusions that they come to.
Talking to James Fishkin, author of the new book, Democracy, When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. And James, let's talk about that different kind of solutions. When we have a choice in a poll, in election, usually the range of options has been narrowed down to, you know, two or three by political parties, by politicians, by experts, things like that. Do you see different solutions, different trade-offs made when people deliberate like this?
Well, yes. Well, usually, look, if there's a referendum, it's just yes or no. Parties have programs, and usually if they have coherent positions, they're packages of policies put together. And so you can just vote for one package or another. But in the deliberative poll, we can disaggregate. We can separate out all the options and probe each of them individually. So if you look at a particular party, you might like something and dislike two or three other things, and then you have to decide how much you care about the thing you like. Well, no, we'll poll on each individual item, and with the arguments for and against each individual item, we can get a quite nuanced picture of what the people really want, and separate out the packages and get policymakers to think about what they really should do. And it becomes what I call a route to responsible advocacy. This is what the people wanted, and here's why. And if you, as the policymaker, are actually interested in listening to the people, you here are the reasons that you can cite that really weighed heavily with the sample after we put the whole population of the whole country in one room to think about it.
All right, so you've got this group of people, this representative sample of a state, a country, a European Union, whatever. They've come out with their recommendations on whatever the issue might be. And practically, in your experience, then what? Do their reports go in a file cabinet, or do they actually lead to policy changes?
Well, I'll tell you a few cases going way back and some very recent where the results were very consequential. So years ago in Texas, a Public Utility Commission, we worked with them and the eight then regulated utilities about how Texas was going to get its energy for electricity, coal, natural gas, wind power, conservation, piping in the stuff from Mexico. Those were the main options, although sometimes the nuclear came up at a later point and an earlier point. Well, so to everyone's surprise, the percentage in the eight projects, the public's willingness to pay more on its monthly bill to support wind power, even if it was just slightly more, went from 50% to 85%. And so the Public Utility Commission and the legislature instituted a series of changes over the years that led Texas from being last among the 50 states, number 50, to being number one in wind power by 2007, surpassing California. That was implemented and has been good for the state to have all that wind power. It keeps growing and growing. A couple of months ago, South Korea, where we had done some earlier projects, faced this big choice when the new government came in. The new government was anti-nuclear, but they had these two nuclear reactors, Shingori 5 and 6, that were partially constructed already. And we're expected online, and we're going to keep the cost of electricity low and allow them to avoid investing in a lot of fossil fuels. And so there were clear arguments on either side, but the government had committed itself to getting rid of nuclear power. And so they decided, to my amazement, they said, we're going to let the people decide. And they sponsored quite rigorously a national deliberative poll. And the people moved decisively, 59% supporting the continuation of the construction of the two nuclear reactors for the reasons that I just alluded to. And that's what the government accepted. In other words, there was a hard choice, and they said, let the people decide. So the people did.
We're talking to James Fishkin. His new book is called Democracy, When the People Are Thinking. Talk about the idea of deliberative polling, getting people together, representative groups of people together to learn about and discuss an issue and see where they stand. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for James about how this works in practice? Is this an idea that you think could improve our political discussions? Is there an issue you'd want to try this on in your local community, in your state? Do you have concerns about how this might work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with James Fishkin. His new book is called Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. Talking about deliberative democracy, deliberative polling. These are events that put people together to learn about and discuss political issues and come to decisions. And the decisions may not be what they thought they would be coming in. Call 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Do you have questions about how this works? Do you think this sounds like a way that we could break through some of the polarization, the partisanship, and the feeling that people's voices aren't heard in politics? Would you want to try this in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. Stan is with us in Green Bay. Hello, Stan.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. I love the idea. I have no problem with direct democracy with one major caveat, and that is that the money spent on both sides would have to be roughly equal. So if I'm a nuclear argument, for instance, if one side can spend $100 million and the other side can only spend $100,000, well, obviously you're going to get tons of science pro and none against. So as long as the money is roughly equal and there's no dark money, and I would have no problem with direct democracy.
Stan, thanks for the call. And James, this isn't exactly direct democracy. This isn't everybody in the state or country votes on an issue. That said, Stan's concerns about one side or the other having more influence, being able to put their finger on the scale in these deliberative events. Is that a concern?
Well, it's not a concern for the deliberative events. It is a concern for direct democracy, because with direct democracy, there's a tremendous amount of money required even to set the agenda, that is, for the signature collection. In California, it runs about $3 million or so to get the even to get something on the ballot. And then that just gets you on the ballot, and then you've got all the problem of the television advertising to support a proposition or oppose it. And that's been pretty dark money. So, in fact, we did. The deliberative poll, by contrast, is a scientific sample of the people. So the people in microcosm deliberate, and they represent everybody, and there's a fair playing field for considering the arguments. So in California, we did a statewide deliberative poll, and one of the issues was reform of the initiative system. And some of the reforms that came out that rated really at the top at the end actually got implemented. There were So the situation had been before our project that once you devise an initiative and you collect the signatures, it's sort of like a contract that you can't change anything about the initiative, even if people figure out that there's some big problem. So we had considered various ways in which people, in which the proponents of the initiative could modify the and improve the reform after public consultation. Secondly, the big problem was nobody knew who was spending the money in favor and against. It was very hard to figure out. Technically, the stuff was filed eventually, but it was not transparent and available. So there was the legislature listened to these problems and actually passed a law that made some changes for greater transparency about the top funders in favor and against, and for allowing a process where the problems in an initiative, once it had been once it had gotten enough signatures of the rest, once it had qualified, could be modified or improved in collaboration with the proponent, the people who put the initiative on. So we actually improved the initiative system and helped. We helped. We were among the coalition of many good groups that helped improve the initiative system in California. But direct democracy is a very flawed process, as you can see from the Brexit referendum, or at least as far as I can tell, everybody agrees that the public in Britain did not have good information on either side, and has now gotten itself into a big mess. So the Brexit referendum is an example of the problem of direct democracy. This is not direct democracy. It's as I say, democracy with a representative sample that deliberates on behalf of the people, but that represents everybody.
Thanks for that call, Stan. We'll go next to Felicia in Milwaukee. Felicia, hi.
Hi. You mentioned that you seek out experts so that you can present information from all sides of an issue. I'm just wondering, how do you go about choosing those experts? Because one issue that I really care about and has affected me personally, which is vaccines, like I never hear anybody presenting information from the experts that I follow in the vaccine issue, and that includes people like Dr. Martin Paul, Dr. Zimmerman from Johns Hopkins University, people like C.C. Doucette that's gotten the 9 bills in the Massachusetts legislature.
Felicia, thanks for the call. So, James, how do you pick the experts so that everybody on all sides is happy about them?
Well, you get an advisory group on the issue that does represent competing sides on the issue, and they approve a range of experts. A range of experts who speak, who answer questions, but represent the perspective in favor or against a policy proposal. So, if a deliberative poll were held on a given issue, then you'd want you'd want the advisory group to consult the prominent experts on either side, and you'd want to make sure that there was coverage on both sides.
We've got an email from Jessica. Jessica says, how can I incorporate these skills concerning deliberative democracy in my high school classroom? So any suggestions, James, for a high school teacher to teach students how to do this?
Well, if you go to the Center for Deliberative Democracy website, which is cdd.stanford.edu, you'll find a high school toolkit. We have worked out ways of doing this in the classroom, and it's been very useful. And in the classroom. And if you correspond with the center, I have a staff member who will assist you.
All right. Good luck, Jessica. In our last minute and a half or so, James, what do people say about this process after they come out of it, the everyday citizens who take part?
They love it. They say, when can I be selected again? What can I do? And we find that it's transformative. When we did the very first one, which was in the United Kingdom, we went back. We saw that not only did the people become more informed, but we went back a year later, and we found out that they were even more informed than at the end of the weekend. In other words, we had sort of activated them as citizens. And we've done that. We found that in a number of countries. So once people realize, once people get involved because they think their voice matters, they find other ways to make their voice matter. So it activates civic engagement.
It's a good place to leave it. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to James Fishkin. He's a professor of political science and communication at Stanford University. He directs the Center for Deliberative Democracy. He's been talking to us about the ideas in his new book. It's called Democracy When the People Are Thinking, Revitalizing Our Politics Through Public Deliberation. Well, there's still time for you to publicly deliberate on this idea and what you think of it. We'd love to hear more from you. Is there an issue you'd like to try this on, statewide, nationwide, or maybe at the local level? Is there something that you think this process, bringing community members together to talk about an issue, getting information from different sides of the issue, and then coming up with your own solutions, is this something you think could help fix whatever issue is on your mind? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or send us an email. That's ideas@WPR.org. Again, ideas@WPR.org. Interested in hearing what you think? Here on Central Time, we've talked about the dangers of avocado hand. That's when people cut their hands while they're cutting up avocados. It's a thing. Now we see in the news another hazard, pineapple cuts, but not from real pineapples. The Cracker Barrel chain of restaurants has issued a recall for decorative pineapples. These are pineapple tchotchkes. They're carved out of driftwood, apparently. You could buy them, well, you could buy them, you can't anymore, at the restaurants to decorate your home. The leaves on the top of the pineapple, they're made out of metal. And there's your problem. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission has received at least a couple of complaints that the leaves are really sharp and people have cut their hands on them, in one case requiring stitches. Cracker Barrel is offering a full refund on these sharp pineapples. Don't expect, you know, a mass number of injuries here. They only sold about 1,500 of these things. The next question is, what about the real pineapples? I don't buy them very often, but the actual leaves are really dry and pokey, and then the edges, you know, they're really rough. And I had to go online the first time I bought a pineapple to find out how to cut them up. Plus, I'm terrible at choosing ripe pineapples, and I never know when to cut them up before they go bad. So I don't know, maybe you're better off with the hazardous, pointy, metal-tipped pineapples than the real thing. I don't know. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.